Rick Sanchez here. This is Direct Impact, and this is what we're going to be talking about.
We shouldn't be the world's policemen, and we can't eradicate every cruelty and injustice in the world. But America can be and must be a force for good.
But are we? Are we a force for good, or are we really doing what we can to be a force for good? The former president and the former first lady give command performances for Kamala Harris. We're going to examine it, though, and we're going to play it for you. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this. All right, let's get started with day two of the Democratic convention. Seemed to go off basically without a hitch. Nobody stormed the stage. The Palestinian protests have not seemingly taken over, as some people expected they might, or taken the attention of the media. And it seemed like the person who made the best pitch for Kamala Harris is the person who actually said she's the most like Kamala Harris. Here.
Kamala Harris and I built our lives on those same foundational values. Even though our mothers grew up an ocean apart, they shared the same belief in the promise of this country. Kamala worked her way up to become Vice President of the United States of America. My girl, Kamala Harris, is more than ready for this moment.
My girl. It was a well-received performance, right? In what amounts to pretty much a Broadway performance, which is what these political conventions for both sides have now become. And there's no news there. By the way, her husband followed suit with another impressive performance, which loyalists in the crowd, I mean, that's what you get at conventions, absolutely ate up.
We do not need four more years of bluster and bumbling and chaos. We have seen that movie before, and we all know that the sequel is usually worse. America's ready for a new chapter. America's ready for a better story. We are ready for a President Kamala Harris.
There you go. I mean, look, there's no doubt, right, that there's something infectious, something seemingly genuine about the former President Barack Obama's oratory. We've always known that. And listen, the gray hair, it doesn't hurt either at this point. But behind the smooth veneer, there's this question of intellectual honesty. Is that the right word? Intellectual honesty, in many ways? Is he really being straight with Americans or even the people there at that convention? Or is he being intellectually dishonest? Watch this comment.
We shouldn't be the world's policemen, and we can't eradicate every cruelty and injustice in the world. But America can be and must be a force for good. Discouraging conflict, fighting disease, promoting human rights, protecting the planet from climate change, defending freedom, brokering peace. That's what Kamala Harris believes, and so do most Americans.
So last night when I was listening to his speech, at home, of course, with my wife, taking notes because, you know, I'm a nerd and I got to do this stuff, I made a list of those things that he just said. So, and let's talk about those real quick here. He said, not being the world's policeman, discouraging conflict, what the United States does, right? We discourage conflict. We are not the world's policeman. We promote human rights. We're doing the most to improve climate change. What else? Defending freedom and brokering peace. Okay, let's take these one at a time. Fine. First, we are the world's police. But in many ways, like a crooked cop, we only patrol the rich neighborhoods where we think we can somehow get something out of it. Do we discourage conflict? Hell no. Iraq, Syria, Libya, Gaza. I mean, how did we discourage those things from happening? Most would argue we caused them, or at least helped. Promote human rights? One word, Gaza. We do the most to improve climate change? I looked this one up last night. We make up 4% of the world's population. but we're responsible for 14% of the world's carbon emissions. These are just facts, okay? We defend freedom? Really? Let's just talk about Venezuela real quick as an example. We fomented 5 coups in Venezuela. We've then recruited and trained and appointed 2 presidents and presidential candidates. That's freedom for the people of Venezuela. It's not. We broker peace deals? Where? 3 times we failed to broker a deal in Gaza when it was possibly available. And 2 times we told Ukraine to walk away from any peace deals with Russia. So look, Manila, let me bring you in on this. Look, I'm not arguing that we should be, that he should stand up there and be negative and just say, we can't do anything or anything like that. We shouldn't be negative about this country that you and I love as much as he does and as much as many Americans do. I think what I'm arguing for here, and maybe that's the reason we do this show, is just a sense of realism, you know, a sense of, you know, comparative intellectual honesty, that the way I would do with my kids or with myself or with my wife or with my football team if I coached one, you know? I wouldn't constantly be telling them that they won when they lost. And that's kind of a problem with Mr. Obama and with our political system. How do you see it?
Well, Rick, if you coached a football team and if you were as good a man as Tim Walz apparently is, as they kept saying last night, and how kind Kamala Harris is, as they were saying last night. So we're seeing this theme, and as you aptly pointed out, that this is all a show. None of this is actually genuine. I think what we heard from Barack Obama, as well as Michelle, is the ideals of what America should be, painting America as if this was JFK's, you know, early 1960s America. Mm. That's not who we've become. This coming from a 2-time former U.S. president who authorized more than 500 drone strikes during his 8 years as president, killing thousands of people, many of them innocent civilians,
yeah,
then going on to win the Nobel Peace Prize after, that's, you know, that's, droning.
That's a fair criticism.
You know, yeah. And then he's over here telling us about, you know, peace and monitoring the world to spread democracy. It's all a matter of how you define democracy, how you define peace. And Barack Obama is, you know, because he is such a great orator, as well as his wife. We should point out both the Obamas are great orators, and they command a lot of, I think they kind of have the je ne sais quoi, as they say, right?
Yeah, and,
they
and listen,
command your attention.
And that's important. Good for that.
So
that's
we
important.
Forget.
No, that's important in politics. And I think, you know, I think Mr. Trump wishes that he would be able to read a teleprompter as well as either Mr. or Mrs. Obama can read a teleprompter, or a lot of other people for that matter. But I think the point that I'd like to make, and the point that why we're having this discussion, is get beyond the veneer of a beautifully read teleprompter and examine the words. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen in these conventions. It used to in the past, but it doesn't happen anymore because conventions are now
just... There's no fact-checking.
Well, no, it's beyond that. They're just commercials. It's a commercial. There's no fact-checking to do. There's no facts. I mean, it's just, you know, hey, aren't we great? And lots of great music. Anyway, let's move to the other thing on the geopolitical front. In case you haven't heard, Germany's now pulling back on its enormous contribution to the funding of Ukraine. So I checked to see what kind of impact this is having. Look at this. This is what I found when I was looking for this. Look at that article. What does it say? It's sending defense stocks into a plunge. Defense stocks fall as Germany plans to reject Ukraine. The folks who have been feeding off of this trough are now worried that this will become a trend, with other European countries telling Washington, look, we've had enough of sending all of our treasure over to Ukraine. And here's how this is also interesting. I checked on Bloomberg this morning to see how they were reacting to this. This is from London this morning, Bloomberg News. Here's the presenters and their, you know, political, or pardon me, their business analysts having a discussion. I think some of the insight here is interesting. Watch it. Let's watch it together.
Ukraine is fascinating in as much as, A, we've got a story on the ground that is developing and is quite hard to call as to the impact that the Ukrainian incursion into Russian territory, which we haven't seen, obviously, since the Second World War, is going to have. But also the funding story in Europe. You've been focusing on Germany.
I think it's a really fascinating one. We know these kind of debt discussions, or these budget discussions, I should say, out of Germany are crucial. But the fact that they're actually pulling back back on Ukrainian aid. I think it's going to be something like 6% of what it was previously, is massive, because it's already being used as rhetoric going back to the States from the Trump campaign, saying, well, look, if Europe's largest economy isn't helping kind of fund the aid towards Ukraine, why should the United States? That's one argument that's showing up in the U.S. political sphere, not to mention what kind of precedent does it set for other countries within Europe as well.
Bingo, right? She's right. I mean, if other countries look at this and say, well, wait, if Germany's not going to put any money in this, why the hell are we going to put any money in this? And then there's the question of how Kamala Harris, if she becomes president, as the polls seem to indicate right now, how is she going to play off this, being the, you know, the daughter of Indian parents or partial Indian parents? It's fascinating. And then I was also fascinated by the fact that he starts off talking about, well, but there's this incursion going on, which shows that that incursion was manifested as a way to get people to say, squirrel, and look the other way. And it may be working. and it may be working, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right on that, Rick. It definitely, this small incursion, albeit impactful for getting attention, has little to do with the ultimate outcome of the way this war will ultimately end, Rick. And that will, of course, have to be Ukraine coming to the table at one point or another, because the funds are drying out. So let's go back to what's actually happening in Germany. Mm-hmm. We know that the Germans are the economic powerhouse, the economic engine of the European Union. And they have been funding a very distant second, but still second behind the United States, this Ukraine war. Mm-hmm. I mean, the U.S. is in the hundreds of billions. They're in it for, you know, the tens of billions. But relative to economic size, okay, that's fair. But the new finance minister, Christian Lindner, now he is notoriously very hawkish when it comes to keeping the budget intact. I guess we could compare him almost to kind of a Ron Paul libertarian type of keeping the budget nice and squeaky clean.
Good for him.
And so he's the one that's kind of pulling the plug on this. He sent a letter that got leaked. I don't know by who. We don't know yet at this point, but the letter got leaked earlier this month in August. He sent a letter to the defense ministry basically saying, we're pulling the plug on Ukraine. I'm trying to balance the budgets. You cannot take any more money from Germany's coffers in 2025. You're going to have to look elsewhere. And I suggest you and the G7 go look in the frozen Russian assets if you want to fund this war. But it ain't coming from inside the country. So this is going to be a huge change of the flow of weapons and, of course, aid overall. And to your point, what's going to happen depending on who gets elected here in November? Who's going to keep funding it?
Well, yeah, and they're looking at the situation and they're asking themselves, this looks like a lost cause to a certain extent. So we're throwing good money at a bad situation. Do we need to keep doing that? Of course, Mr. Zelensky is trying to create a diversion so that they look at it and say, oh, okay, maybe we'll hold back to see how this ends up. And, you know, most geopolitics and military people will tell you that's probably not going to end well for him one way or another. So
Finance minister doesn't care if you're like doing a shock tactic over there. He says, I don't care. There's not enough money in my coffers for this country. All right, War Department, go look somewhere else, period.
When we come back, thanks, Manila. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this and this as well. So Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is heading to Ukraine to talk, we think, about some kind of peace deal with Mr. Zelensky. And the man that we're going to be talking about this with has, interestingly enough, he's written an awful lot of books. He's a respected historian. He's an author. He's a commentator. That's Vijay Prashad you're looking at right there. He's a really smart guy. Interesting, just wrote a book about Cuba, the place I was born. We'll talk to him when we come back. We'll be right back.
there's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy.
Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
What planet are we living on, man?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
I've wanted to come here since I was 12. When my grandfather told me that his mom came from Russia, that I was part Russian, I didn't plan on staying this long. I was gonna look around, I was gonna see if it was for me. But then I came, and then I was like, I don't ever wanna go home.
I've never been happier in life than I am here in Russia.
I've only lived here a few months, but I wanted to tell you what fascinates me about Russia and share the stories of other foreigners who live here. Like Jay, who worked as a chef and now raises goats and makes cheese in the countryside.
Cheese.
Like Chad, who's been granted political asylum because he's being persecuted by the FBI.
U.S. embassies in four countries that come after me, it's wild.
Like an American family that recently moved to Russia with six children.
I've never felt safer in my entire life than living here.
So welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact. If you want to understand geopolitics, you need to read Vijay Prashant. His latest book is entitled On Cuba. Interestingly enough, that certainly got my attention. Reflections of the 70-year-old struggle. But listen, this guy's also written a lot of other books. There's the On Cuba book, which is out now. He's also written Struggle Makes Us Human, Washington's New Cold War. In fact, if I sat here now and started listing all of his books, we would never be able to have a conversation. Hi, Vijay.
Hi, great to be with you. Thanks a lot.
Likewise. Let's start with Modi going to visit with Mr. Zelensky. What do you make of that? You think he's going to anger the Russians for doing that?
I don't think so. I think it's really important to put Mr. Modi's trip as well as India's relationship with Russia in context. After the Soviet Union collapsed, India began to get very close to the United States and in many ways subordinated Indian national interest to the interests of, you know, the United States, other G7 countries, and so on. Well, in recent years, India has been asserting its national interest. It's very interesting. One of the reasons why India didn't condemn Russia in February 2022 was that India wanted to continue to buy Russian oil. When the Indian foreign minister, S. Jaishankar, a very distinguished diplomat, was asked, you know, why are you continuing to buy oil? He said something very interesting. He said, you know, what India buys in a year from Russia, Europe buys in an afternoon. Think about it. Then on another occasion, he was asked, would India join NATO Plus? And he said, no, we don't accept the NATO worldview. This is an interesting and important thing that's happening in India. You see, Mr. Modi was in Russia in July. He embraced Vladimir Putin. There was a photograph that circulated.
Yeah.
Vladimir Zelensky attacked that embrace, saying that, you know, this is disgusting and so on. Well, Mr. Modi is going to Ukraine. He's met Zelensky before. He met Zelensky at the margins of various meetings, most recently in May at the G7 meeting. So it's not that they are strangers. But I think you've got to understand that when this conflict began, there were 20,000 Indian students in Ukraine. And India had to work with the Ukrainian government to evacuate these students.
That makes sense.
On the one hand, Modi is going to say, well, thanks a lot, Vladimir, for helping us and so on. And then he's going to carry the message that, look, all wars end in negotiation. you might as well negotiate now. I mean, you should have negotiated in February of 2022 in Belarus. You should have negotiated in March 2022 in Turkey. And we know Boris Johnson came in and said, don't negotiate. He said that on behalf of the United States. Lloyd Austin came, said, don't negotiate. The Chinese have been saying negotiate. Now the Indians are saying negotiate. The center of gravity of the world has moved to Asia. If Ukraine, which cannot take itself out as a neighbor of Russia and deposit itself in Iowa, if Ukraine wants to survive as a real country, it has to listen to China, India, other countries that are effectively in its neighborhood.
Not just Washington. Let me ask you a question. I wonder what your opinion is. As I'm sitting here talking to you, I was thinking about this. We may soon have a partial or half Indian president of the United States in Kamala Harris. Her parents are Indian. I don't know if I phrased that correctly, but you know what I mean. I would think that gives her a very different perspective of the world than somebody like Joe Biden, who thinks he's, you know, John Wayne and wants to just kill, kill, kill and start wars everywhere because we're America and we can do that. Do you think, just from your read of her so far, that she will differentiate herself when it comes to foreign policy and not necessarily be all over the South China Sea and, you know, bombing Iran and giving 100% support to Israel and saying that we gotta, you know, help destroy Russia by giving more money to Ukraine, all these things that her predecessor did. What do you think?
Well, look, you know, you started the show by playing the clip from former President Barack Obama. He has a very similar biography as Kamala Harris. His father was from Kenya. His mother was, an American woman. Kamala Harris's mother was from India. Her father is from Jamaica. They met while graduate students in California. Mm-hmm. They have something similar between Obama and Kamala Harris. Manila was saying earlier that during Obama's tenure, he droned, you know, illegal extrajudicial droning of several people, including Anwar Olalaki, born in Las Cruces, Mexico, yeah. New Mexico. He was killed. And then a few months later, his son, 16-year-old Abdul Rahman Olalaki, born in Denver, Colorado, 16 years old, was droned, killed under Mr. Obama. So, I mean, does having some foreign experience, Mr. Obama in Indonesia, for instance, where his mother had relocated him, does that change your view of the world? I would think it does a little bit. Does it prevent you from being the front person of a state? Many years ago, a CIA agent said to me, you know, if you have a large enough hammer, everything looks like a nail. The U.S. military is a very large hammer. And it really makes the president sitting in the Oval Office with all the arrogance that that can produce, it makes it feel like you better use this hammer anywhere. Instead of negotiation, let's have confrontation. It's a really, really bad habit, Rick. And I wish the people of the United States would come to terms with the fact the United States is a great country, but it's just another country on the planet, you know. People in the U.S. are people like other people. You don't need to hammer other people. You can talk, you can negotiate, you can find a way to live together. Otherwise, we're basically driving each other to some sort of chaotic mass hatred, which I really am not looking forward to.
Final question. Cuba, I'm fascinated about your book. I'm fascinated about your conversations there and what you've learned talking about using a hammer on a small nail. 70 years now that hammer has been hitting that little country over the head. Is Cuba at fault at all? Is there anything they could do differently? And what do you see for the future of Cuba from this point on?
Well, firstly, you're right. 11 million people, Rick, smaller than New York City. Okay, this is really important for people to understand. It's an extraordinary country, as you well know, since you were born in Cuba. It is really beautiful. It has people of great intelligence and sincerity. Yes, there's a lot that Cuba can do. Cuba can surrender. Cuba can give up and say, bring back the gangsters, Bring back the casinos. Bring back, you know, the big U.S. companies. They can do that. The embargo disappears. But if they want to live as sovereign people, as people who want to develop their own agenda in the world, that is just simply not being allowed by the United States government. You know, in the archive, I found the U.S. government complaining that the U.S., that the Cuban revolution led by Fidel Castro was disobedient. That's the word that was used repeatedly. It is a disobedient country. Castro is disobedient. And I think, you know, Fidel Castro, of all people, is not a child. I've met Castro, as you have,
yeah.
Extremely erudite, bright man, a real symbol of the Cuban people, you know, starts off as a lawyer in Cuba, wants to make a difference, but he was up against gangsterism, you know. I mean, and it's literally the mob.
Yeah.
But also, the Kennedy administration behaved like the mob. They basically said, if you don't listen to us, we're going to whack you. Kept trying to take him out. The Cubans are incredible. During the pandemic, I interviewed a number of Cuban doctors who had gone around the world to work in COVID hot wards. That means wards where people were struggling to survive from COVID. I interviewed a young doctor.
Wow.
She was in Costa Rica in a hot ward. I asked her, where is your family? She said, they're at home in Oriente, in Cuba. I have a young child. I miss him. I Skype with him. She said, but I wouldn't be anywhere else. And I said, why is that?
Yeah.
She said, because I became a doctor to serve. And the Cuban Revolution has taught me that. And I felt, my God, at a time in the United States, for instance, when people were hoarding vaccines, here were the Cubans going out there and helping people. And when the United States placed Cuba on the state sponsor of terrorism list, I reacted very poorly to that because I said, they're not state sponsors of terrorism. They are state sponsors of public health. And you don't get to be penalized for being a state sponsor of public health. I wish I could have a conversation with Marco Rubio to try to encourage him to see this differently. But Mr. Rubio is hell-bent on maintaining the strangulation of this little island.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's politics. And unfortunately, it involves money and it doesn't involve goodwill. And it's not just Marco Rubio, by the way. There's a whole hell of a lot of them. Vijay, what an honor, what a pleasure. Enjoyed the conversation. Thanks so much for sharing some of your wisdom with you. Let's do more conversations like this, if you're willing to come on.
Always a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. That's our show. Remember, always look outside your own box. Truths, they don't live in boxes, I like to say. I'm Rick Sanchez. We'll be looking for you next time.